We're doing Pirkei Avot with the Jewish Home. We're up to the fifth chapter, the seventh Mishnah. We had begun the Mishnah. The Mishnah tells us Shiva Dvarim Begolem. There are seven traits and one who is not yet refined. And we had spoken about the idea that it's not yet refined. Golem is a vessel that has not yet been refined, but is yet to be refined. Meaning, we said one of the things the Mishnah is teaching us is the concept of hope. The idea that within a relationship, you have to give capacity for change. The Mishnah doesn't say he's a dunce, he's got the IQ of a child. The Mishnah says he's a person who is not yet refined. The Mishnah calls him a golem to teach us this idea that he is someone who is, he's just not yet there, but he could get there. And so we had discussed last time different stories that illustrate this, and we ended off with the story of the date where the guy was in Midtown Manhattan, and he stopped at a light, and the girl asked him a question about something personal, and he didn't want to tell her, and the girl said, "Tell me," and he said, no, it's not something I feel comfortable saying." And he's standing at the light, she shifts the car into park, pulls out the keys and says, "I'm not getting him back until you tell me." And the light turns green, and the people behind him start honking, and she's holding the keys, and obviously he's Shomer Nagia, he's got nothing to do, and he looks at her, and he's stunned, and she says, "Well, tell me." And the cars are honking. And that's where we left off last time. That's where we left off last time. So the guy was a gentle guy. And no, it's not me. The story happened before I was born, probably. The guy was a gentle guy. And I don't know how the guy got the keys back. I don't know if he told her what she wanted or not. But he got the keys back. And the way you pointed out, at the end of the date, he called it off, and he said, "There's no point in continuing." And he was a gentle guy, though. So she was very interested. So she got someone from her side to go to the guy's Rosh Yeshiva, which happened to be Rav Moshe Feinstein, and ask him to talk to the guy. So the guy came to his Rebbe, and he said, "Rebbe, I know they're trying to push this to start again. Maybe she didn't push it. Maybe she didn't go to the Rosh Yeshiva. Maybe the guy of his own accord went to Rav Moshe." Because he said to Rav Moshe, "Rebbe, what do you think? The girl, this is the story, so why, I thought to call it off with the girl." So Rav Moshe said, "What'd she do? She pulled the keys out of the ignition? So tell her not to do that." So the guy didn't take that piece of advice. He didn't marry the girl. He didn't marry the girl. But we hear that story and we think, what was Rav Moshe thinking? And I say that Rav Moshe taught us something very big from like this Mishnah. You have to be able to discern if there are a bunch of things that's happening or one thing that's happening. And you have to remember that people have capacity. We're not bound by where we are. You and I, we gave a million examples in last class. We gave maybe not a million, but we gave a few examples last class about how in life you walk into marriage and suddenly you discover, as we mentioned last class, your wife overspends on the credit card, your husband doesn't tell the exact truth, your wife expects you to be home at this hour, not a minute later. Your husband says he's going to be home at 7 and doesn't walk through the door till 11. You suddenly discover certain things that are issues. They're not a joke. But you have to remember, the Mishnah calls a person who is not yet refined a golem. Not yet there. We think of a golem as a dunce. But the real definition of the word golem is a vessel that is yet to be refined. No one's saying it's easy. And no one's saying you should go and marry someone who's going to be the most difficult person in the world to work with, because you say, we can all work on things. No. We look for a match that makes sense. But after we get there, we're going to discover there are things that are not the way we thought they were. Yes, we're always going to discover that. And all we have to have is the willingness to work. And we're all going to have to work. There's no such thing as a marriage that doesn't require work. So what are the traits of a person who is refined? Chacham. Eino midaber bifnei mi shu gadol mimenu bechokhma uveminyan. He does not speak in front of someone who's bigger than him, be it in wisdom or in age. Now, this seems obvious, but there are also norms of conversation. And this is a very common issue between couples. Very often wives say, my husband doesn't tell me anything about what's going on in his life. And husbands say, I try and I never get anywhere. And wives say, what do you mean? Tell me. You tell your friends. You tell your mother. Why don't you tell me? And husbands will say, because when I talk to other people, they're interested in hearing. When I talk to you, you're not. And she says, of course I'm interested. So where's the misunderstanding? There are different conversational styles. By women, if you're listening and you're quiet, then you're impolite. That's why when women have a conversation and men listen quietly, women will often ask, are you there? Show a sign of life. Say something. By women, if you're having a conversation and you agree, so you show that you agree by sticking in points and by taking the conversation off on tangents. So if I come and I tell you, boy, did I hurt my leg this morning, and you say, really? I had something just like that the other day. Now, if you're a guy, your feeling is, oh, so he's taking the conversation over to what happened to him. So you listen politely, and the conversation is over. But if you're a girl, so then that's normal. That's how you show you commiserate. So you didn't come to take the conversation from me. You said, yeah, I had something just like that the other day. I twisted my leg, and it was terrible. Now the woman's waiting for you to get back to your topic. From a guy's perspective, you didn't want to hear about my leg. You wanted to tell me about your leg. Okay, I heard you. Goodbye. End of story. You see how conversations end? Men come home and they want to tell their wives, you know what happened today at work? And she says, you had a hard day too? You can't believe what happened today with the kids. And she goes off on a whole tangent and then she's waiting for him to get back. He never gets back to it. You didn't want to hear about my day. You wanted to tell me about your day. No, that's not true. This is the way women have conversations. But men don't take it that way. Men feel like you took the conversation off topic. Okay, I'll listen. Fine, okay. So I won't tell you what happened today. And then women say, wait a second, why don't you tell me? And the guy says, I tried. And the woman says, so continue. And the man says, never mind. But you understand why? Because it's frustrating to us because we have a different conversational style. If by us, if two men talk, so then that interpretation would be correct. I do not want to hear about your leg, I want to tell you about my leg. But if two women are talking, then that's perfectly natural. I was once sitting at a conversation. My wife had a bunch of friends over, and it was a Shabbos table. We were newly married. I don't remember, a few months after we were married. And after the friends left, my wife asked me, why were you so quiet? So I said, I couldn't follow what the topic of conversation was. One girl said this. The other girl reacted with something else. The third girl took it to a different place, and I could never follow, well, what's the point of this conversation? Because every second you're switching topics. I never knew, you know, I don't want to take it off topic. I'm me being male, if I'd say anything that was taken off topic, so I just stayed quiet and I listened to the ping pong of conversation. But that's a very important difference. So the Mishnah tells us that a wise person does not speak before someone who is bigger than him in wisdom and in age. Okay, that's the way we should know to behave, but we should also know that sometimes by women, when they say something, they're coming to show you they're with you. So you might say, you know, I learned an interesting Dvar Torah about, and you're going to try to share it with her, and she's going to come back at you with something, and it's not bad. She's just showing she's involved in the conversation. Uri, I'm with you.
Right, there's a famous thinker in America who saw fit to give a whole series of lectures on the different natures of men and women precisely because of these reasons. All too often, a lack of communication results in like these things. But over the silly things that if you really get down to it, all came from like a misunderstanding. Like, you know, but I thought you said this. I didn't say this. I really meant that. It's because of these things that you have all these problems.
Ve'ino nichnas letoch divrei chaverot. and an intelligent person does not interrupt someone else. And again, these are the traits, this is how we should behave. But just remember that this goes back to conversational styles. There are places where the expectation is that you cut one another off. That if I complete a thought and I don't cut someone else, and so no one cuts me off, then I've been too boring for someone else to partake of the conversation. If you guys pay attention, you'll see there are a lot of people who have conversations that way. They don't let you finish the thought because I already know what you're going to say, right? The last two words of most sentences are superfluous. You see, you knew I was going to say are superfluous. And you knew I was going to say it again this time and the next time, right? Think about it. Most sentences, I don't have to finish the sentence, right? And so there is such a conversational style. Chazal taught us that part of being wise is that we do not interject. We do not cut into someone else's. Ve'eino nivhal la'ashiv. He's not quick to answer. He's not quick to answer. How many marriages would be saved if people were not quick to answer? And this is a habit. Guys, you could acquire this now. It's easy to be slow to answer when things are calm and pleasant, but it's more difficult when you're under attack. Didn't I ask you to? Didn't we agree that you would? Don't you think it's unkind, unfair? Don't you care about me? I don't understand you. Einoni val la'ashiv. Part of being wise is it's not quick to answer. Shoel ka'inyan u'meshiv ka'alacha. He asks on the topic that's at hand, and he answers also. They're one idea. You ask the question that's relevant, you answer the answer that's relevant. You give an answer, la'alacha. Now, on all these points, we have conversational styles. We discussed this already numerous times. The idea of how conversations work and topics and off-topic and on-topic. Women's conversational styles spread out. That's why I recommend that you don't have a chavrusa with your wife, and if you do, be prepared. Your goal is not to cover ground. Your goal is to touch on topics. V'omer al rishon rishon v'al acharon acharon. He answers in the order that he was asked. There's an order. V'al ma shelo shama, omer lo shamati. A person says, if there are things that he doesn't have a tradition on, he says, I don't know. U'moda la'emet, and he admits to the truth, v'chilufehen be'golem. And the golem is the exact opposite. So these are points which Chazal warned us. In the home, it's not so simple. Chazal say, if you apply religious pressure in a home, so then a wife is apt to serve meat that's without a hechsher, because she couldn't find meat with a hechsher. We said, Chacham says the truth. Yes, but Chazal told us that there are certain emotions that are ever present and very sharp, and they override the truth. So if a person applies pressure in the home, so then you can't count on the truth. Sounds strange, doesn't it? But you have to be prepared for it. Chazal say that's the norm. The norm is that a wife feels a certain pressure to live up to whatever pressure you put, and even if you don't put it there. Why do women get all dressed up? Why do they put on all the makeup? How come there's so much perfume for women and not for men? There's a certain need that women have to feel that their husband thinks they're beautiful, that society thinks they're beautiful, there's a woman needs a certain feedback, that she looks good, that she sounds good, that she's well liked, that she's accepted. One of the tips I give every chassan is that the first day you have to compliment your wife on her hair covering. It's the first time in her life she's going to cover her hair, right? So you have to be there and compliment her. And not only the first day, throughout Sheva Brachos. In the beginning, it takes time for a woman to get used to covering her hair. She needs that feedback. Now, that need plays itself out in ways that might not be what you'd like. The child says, "Ima, I don't want to go to school today." You know how many couples I've seen that the mother leaves the kid home and doesn't tell the father? They agree that they'll tell. They agree that they won't, and then it's not what happens. And this plays itself out this way in many things. They agree that they won't spend beyond a certain amount. But you know what? Men are also culprits in this. Only Chazal taught us that with women it's different. And children need a mother and a father, not just two fathers. If a mother were as strict about going to school as a father, it would be a problem. If everything by a mother would be as rigid as it is by a father, then kids would turn out warped. It's not, kids need that balance, the softness with the hardness of a father. They need that balance, but then you can't hold it against her for being what she's supposed to be. So these are traits which by us are interpreted one way, and by them are interpreted a different way. You guys with me? I'm with you.
How do you know to distinguish it between things that are expected because of her nature and other things that really should be are not so acceptable if she goes against her children?
You're talking about dating or marriage? Within a marriage, I don't know that we have to use a yardstick. Meaning, I don't think the question has to be on some scale, is this right or wrong? I think we have to work with the situation at hand. If a husband sees that they agree on a budget and she doesn't live up to the budget, they agree that... let's take a simple case. They agree that when a kid has fever, they'll take his temperature before giving him medicine. Okay? She doesn't. What are you going to do now? They agree that in the morning, before you send the kids out to school, there's not going to be yelling. Any disciplining is going to be done in the afternoon, at night, at other times. Or they agree that on Shabbos it won't happen. So along comes a young man and tells me, "I tried, my wife agrees. Theoretically, she agrees. Practically, the morning is all yelling." So I told him, "Get up a seekin and change your schedule around and be there. And you take out the kids in the morning." Meaning, in life, we have to be realistic. Theoretically, she agrees. Practically, it's not happening. So now, if you feel it's detrimental to the kids, so then be there. Fix it. Don't throw the ball at her. Meaning, we have to be practical. Same thing with the guy who left the milk thing out. So his wife leaves the milk out every night, and he always thinks, you know, why are you doing that? So get up and put it away, or invest in an extra bag of milk every day. Meaning, it's not a question of right and wrong. It's a question of life. This is who the person is. We could talk about it. We can try to move things. But we also have to realize that if they're not going to move, it's still workable. Right? And that's sometimes going to be part of the price. So the guy asked me, "What do? I asked her to take the temperature every time. If a kid has fever, take the temperature. Before you give it, we have to have a record of where the kid's temperature is." So I said to him two things. I said, she agrees with you theoretically, but in the hullabaloo of life, she doesn't get to do it. So you can put the thermometer together with the medicine to try and help her remember. If that doesn't work, you can try to call her and remind her periodically. If you know one of the kids is sick, try to call and remind her. Or you can call a doctor and ask him, how often is it really critical to take the temperature? And chances are he'll tell you, if you do it once or twice a day, it's enough. And you're around once or twice a day to do it, or you could remind her once or twice a day. Most of the time, the arguments are more because we feel like if you agree with me, then why aren't you doing it? And practically, it's not happening. But in truth, we also take it too far. Like that case of taking the temperature, or the case of taking the kids. So I asked the husband, you can't get up a second. Okay, but can you get up a second twice a week? Three times a week? So then what's so terrible if twice a week they get yelled at, and three times a week you take them? Is that so terrible? Meaning, I don't know what yelling's going on in his house. I don't know how bad he feels it is for the kids' growth. But usually you can find a compromise. The difference is the attitude. That's why I asked, are you dating or married? If you're dating, that's a different question. But once you're married, so then the question has to be, how do I make this work? So I can try to talk to the person, and I could try to work with the person to find practical results. And I can also say, right now these are facts. Change is something that takes time for all of us. If these are facts, so how can I make this work? Whether I'm right or I'm wrong or I'm partially right, that can affect how much I should compromise, how much I should try. But at the end of the day, the facts of life force the compromise more than the theory does. You could be 100% right. She'll tell you you're 100% right. You're 1,000,000% right. I shouldn't do it. But I'm not succeeding. Now what? I'll tell you a true story. There was a couple where the wife had diabetes. And the doctors told her she has to stay off her sugar or she's going to lose her sight. She's going to lose her legs. The husband begged her. The husband bought whatever he could with alternative sweets. Money was no object in that house. He tried to do whatever he could, but it didn't work. She lost her sight. She lost both legs. She lost her life. True story. Now, he ended up being a widower, but I'm not sure he could have done differently. So now he was faced with a choice. He tried, and he took her to dietitians, and he tried a million different angles. End of the story, it's not working. So let's say the ticker's ticking. He knows statistically they have 5 years left together, 10 years left together. This is an extreme case, right? He's tried everything, he's going to try. What can he do now? He could tie up her hands and try to keep life a little bit longer. He could stay home and babysit her all day. Maybe he could find some kind of solution that he didn't find. Okay, he could do research. He could try to talk to other people. He could try to get other people to talk to. But it could be, after he's exhausted all possibilities, at the end of the day, it's not going to happen. So then he has a choice to make. Is he going to make both of their lives miserable, trying to fight something which he's not going to win? Or is he going to live with it and make the best of what he has? So I took an extreme case, you know, really extreme. I saw it as it happened, unfortunately. But in life, most cases are not so extreme, and we still have that same choice. You talk, you explain, you try to find solutions, and at the end of the day, it's not changing. What? Very often, yeah.
You have to live for sure.
Very often you can compromise. Very often you can find solutions that work for both of you. But very often you have to say, this isn't going to change. I'm right, but it's not going to change. So now the question is, how do I make this work practically? The fact that I'm right doesn't help me any. She'll also agree you're right.
That's a common thing.
Every marriage. That depends on how quick a person wisens up to the idea that he has to learn to live with it. Meaning the points that happen within a marriage repeat themselves. So it's going to happen many times, the same thing. Now the question is, what do you do with it? So sometimes you have no choice. If she's overspending the credit card and she's destroying the family finances, so then you have to figure out what you're going to do. Extreme situations require extreme measures. And depending on the circumstance, will depend on what you do. But within every marriage, there are going to be very serious things that are very relevant. I had a story not long ago where a woman was pregnant and there were clear signs that the fetus was in danger. And I told her husband, you have to tell your wife that she has to rest because it's not clear that the baby's going to live if she doesn't stay in bed. And the woman didn't listen. So 2 weeks later, I get a phone call. They're in the hospital. So now she's hospitalized. And things are not looking good. So thank God, as of today, she's in forced bed rest and the baby's doing okay. But what do you do now? You know, you've exhausted all possibilities. At some point you say, I'm going to do my best, and she's responsible. I can't do more than that. So the husband did 1,000,000%, you know. He took off half his work, you know. He cut down his work to bread and water. That's all, you know, earned enough to pay rent and have bread and water, and took off every other hour to be home and do everything he could do so she should stay in bed. He took it seriously, and she also theoretically took it seriously. But what am I going to do when this baby's crying? What am I going to do when this and that? Okay, now what? So now, after you've done everything, you can try to do everything under the planet, but at the end of the day, there comes a point where you say, I can't do more, so what am I going to do? Am I going to spend my time fighting? If you think that's going to get you somewhere, try. You're welcome to blow up and do everything under the planet. We're talking about a human life here. If you think it'll get you somewhere, try.
It's a
very tough pill to swallow. We tried every angle possible. I said to him, you know, is she going to listen to her mother? Is she going to listen to her sister? Who's she going to listen to? Should I come over? Should I yell at her? You want me to call the chief rabbi? Who do you want me to call? You know, it's a human life. I'm willing to call whoever she's going to listen to. Yeah. But at the end of the day, if you've exhausted every measure under the planet, the doctor yells, the mother yells, the husband yells, everyone begs her, explains to her, tries. She's her own boss. What are you going to do? So you say, I have two choices. Either try to do something that's futile, or make the best of the current situation. What do I do now? I'm gonna try to find compromise. I'm gonna try to find angles to minimize it. I'm gonna try to find ways to alleviate the situation. I'm gonna do everything that's intelligent. But if after all that, this is still a situation, so I have to be able to make it work with that as a given. I don't have a choice. Now, maybe the solution is he has to talk to a rabbi. Maybe next time he has to tell her, don't go to mikvah. We're not having any more children under these conditions. Maybe, you know, extreme cases deserve extreme responses. There might be, but we're not talking about the next time. Maybe the next time he has to figure something out. And there has to be something very, very clear next time. Maybe. I wonder if that would really work. I tend to think not. Maybe. You know, I'm giving you one example. These examples play themselves out numerous times. And the wife that begs her husband not to smoke, and the doctors tell him he's going to die, and he comes home smelling of smoke, that's not the same story. And the wife that begs her husband to eat cholesterol-free food, and behind her back he goes and snacks. And these are all stories I saw with my own two eyes and went to their funerals. I'm not talking about stories theoretical. I'm talking about stories where I see the Yisomim. I hear the kids' Kaddish. But this is life. People are human. They have the human weaknesses. What are you going to tell her? Get divorced and I'll live life alone. Okay, so you could go to a therapist. You could use every venue that's out there to try and resolve the situation. And I'm all for it. But sometimes after you've exhausted every venue, the person is not changing. So an intelligent person tries every angle to get the person to change. I'm not saying not to try. I'm saying yes to try. Try every angle. And sometimes you end up with a situation that they're not changing. So what are you going to do now? So then you have to make it work. You have to figure out how to make it work with them. But again, I'm all for using every angle. I've seen people go to hypnosis. I've seen people do everything under the planet to try and change it. It's not funny. A guy that's overweight, and the doctors are telling him he doesn't have too many years left to live continuing like this, and he says, I don't have the self-control. I saw people spend millions, lose every penny they've had, and they know they shouldn't do it, but they don't have the self-control. Now, what are you going to tell the wife? Go be miserable, be divorced. So he can't contain himself. He's a gambler. He's losing the house. He's losing the car. He's lost everything. So I'll tell her, don't funnel more money into that account. You know, try to get him to rehabilitation. Try to get him help. Let's work on getting him to Gamblers Anonymous. Get him out of it. But at the end of the day, Right now, it hasn't worked. The world around you is filled with people who have tried to conquer themselves and not succeeded. So part of the reason is because it's very, very hard, and a person has to try very, very hard. And most people are not willing to put up that fight. Most people would rather just live life the way it is. But this is something that repeats itself in many people's lives. So some people find a way out. So I know couples where the wife knows the husband has to diet, she goes on his diet. And that's the food she makes for both of them. And she goes for walks with him, and she goes jogging with him, and she's successful. Because she found a way, like the story of the husband who didn't want the wife yelling at the kids, she found a way that she will compensate for his lackings. So that's what a husband has to do, and that's what a wife has to do. You can't stand on the sidelines, use a yardstick, and say, this is what's right, this is what you should do. Most people cannot live that way. So what your question was, what's right, and where are the limits? I don't think that's the question. We're dealing with human beings. We're not dealing with a yardstick of what's right and wrong. So with human beings, we have to try to figure out what's going to work, not what's right. What's right has very little relevance. We're in it together, and so together we have to figure out how we're going to overcome this. And hopefully you find a solution. I told one husband, stay home. Don't leave the house. They're telling you that if she gets out of bed, the baby's going to die. You stay home. You'll lose your job. Fine, but stay home. We'll figure something out. So it worked for a day, it worked for 2 days, and then she promised him she won't get out of bed. She promised him, she was in forced bed rest. She promised, and he took out the kids, and he did everything, and she got out of bed. Okay, it's not an easy challenge. She just wanted to help him with the dishes. She just wanted to help him with the laundry. She just wanted to surprise him. She meant well. Thank God she ended up in the hospital, and the baby lived. The baby lived. But you know, he told her, I'm going to lose my job, but I'd rather lose my job and not lose the baby. And that's what he did. He stayed home till she promised him she wouldn't do anything. He didn't lose his job. But he made it clear to her that he was ready to lose his job, meaning he stayed home day after day until he felt confident that she really wouldn't get out of bed. And she didn't. She got out of bed. And risked the baby's life. You know, it's a very hard challenge to be in bed, and she meant well. What do you say now? You don't say divorce. You say figure out how to make it work. Yeah.
My question was from way back, but I'm going to just ask, and it's not related to the fact that it's on top of the control. I was having a conversation with somebody the other day, and you know, I said sometimes it's hard when you see because you don't have someone to turn to whenever you're having this problem in life, that problem in life, and you want someone to talk to, and you want someone who's there for you. Someone's like, well, here's the thing: before you get married, you've got to be your own pillar of strength. You've got to be your own this and your own that. You've got to be really strong. You've got to be your own person. To which I responded, well, if everything was just fine and dandy, why would I ever bother to get married? If I could like do everything myself and be my own pillar of strength, so to speak.
Right. I agree. I think that Rav Simcha Cohen said that, what you just said, he said it on the pasuk. It says, Moshiv asirim baita. Moshiv yechidim baita, motzi asirim bakosherot. The pasuk in Tehillim describes how Hashem takes two single people, puts them in a home, and then the pasuk calls them as people in bondage. Motzi asirim. What's the bondage? So he explains that the bondage that keeps us in a marriage is the fear of loneliness out of the marriage. Meaning when a person's alone, he's alone. And he has no partner in life. And the nicest and sweetest and best thing on the planet is having that partner in life. There is nothing better in life. It takes work. It doesn't happen easily. But it is the best thing on the planet. And it's not my thought. The Gemara says it. The Gemara says, look at how good a good wife is. That when the Hashem wanted a comparison to the Torah and a comparison to his relationship with Am Yisrael, he said, the best thing to compare it to is a relationship between a husband and a wife. Shir Shirim, Mishle. Repeatedly we see that's the allegory. When you want to say something good, that's the best allegory in the world, because it's the best thing in the world. But we have to come in with realistic expectations. Realistic expectations means we are going to have human foibles, human weaknesses, and we will have to compensate for one another, and we can't work it with a yardstick. You know, this is what's right, so this is what you should do, so I'm not going to accept less than that. No. We couldn't live that way, they can't live that way. In the relationship, we compensate for one another's weaknesses, and what's right has less relevance than we would imagine. It's more a practical question. This is where it's at, now how are we going to make it work? So if we have this weakness, let's think together, how are we going to make it work? And it involves thinking together. And if you approach the conversation that way, if you don't come to the conversation and say, look, you're supposed to be in bed rest, you're going to get out of bed, you're going to kill the baby. It's that simple, stay in bed. Okay? You approach it that way, she's going to say, I'm going to stay in bed, and either she will or she won't. You approach it and you say, look, I know it's hard to stay in bed, and I know you love helping around the house. And I ask myself, we both know how dangerous it is if you get out of bed. How are we going to contend with this challenge? Because it's going to be very hard. And I don't see how we're going to do it. Notice it's the we contending with the challenge. Notice it's a challenge. It's not what the male mind would say. Our mind would say, what's the challenge? You're going to kill me if you get out of bed. There's no challenge. Stay in bed. That's what you want to say as a husband, right? It's very simple. There's no questions here. You have to stay in bed. Right? That's what you want to say. But that's not what you can say. And you could try it. But more often than not, what needs to happen is, we're in this together and we have this hardship. So let's be in that hardship together. Instead of me standing on the sidelines and saying, you know, this is what you should do. And I'm right. I'm right. Now I'm going to approach it and say, okay, we have this hardship. We have this challenge. How are we going to overcome it? That's totally different. And the way we are going to overcome it, the way we're going to make any headway is by working on it together as our challenge. Even though it's not my challenge. I'm going to do everything for you to stay in bed. Just do that. That's all I'm asking of you. Okay, but you see it's not working. You notice how I'm approaching it with less expectations. You're welcome to approach it the other way first. I'm all for it. Try it. Talk about it. You don't have to concede at the onset that you're not going to get anywhere. But if you reach a point where you have to concede, so then don't view that concession as failure. That concession is marriage. Now we're in it together, now we're going to figure it out together in light of the fact that we have this weakness. We have this weakness. Yeah, she's the part of the we that has this weakness. But at the end of the day, we have this weakness because we're in it together. So now the question becomes, how do we make this work because we have this weakness? You with me? Uri, we're out of time. If it's short, I'm with you. I don't want to keep the guys.
I was going to say, like, if you have a problem with your left hand, what are you going to do? Try and fix it with the right hand or sever the hand? You know, if you have a logical person to try and fix the problem, you know, like bandage it or fix it, just because he gets a cut on the finger doesn't mean he's going to sever the whole hand.
Right, but what I'm saying is that sometimes if it's your hand, you would say, well, I'm just going to leave that hand in the sling and not use it because it needs to heal itself. And somehow the hand's not listening. So that's when it becomes a problem.